I thought it was supposed to rain today, Mike. Maybe that's only up north, is it? He's talking. So any more questions? Anything we've talked about, one and many and so forth? Yes? Did you hear the question? The Hinayana ideal, or the Hinayana main aim, is to become, go to your own personal liberation, this sort of lesser, swifter path, and not to aim for full Buddhahood. So where do Buddhas come from then, in the Hinayana, in their view? The foundational vehicle, that's what Brunhilde calls it. Instead of the Hinayana, foundational vehicle. So that's not a straightforward translation, but it's kind of a nicer name anyway. So in the foundational vehicle, they certainly do accept Buddhas, but either they say, I think they the best answer is to say the Buddhas are very rare beings. So there's only one wheel-turning Buddha every, a few million eons or something. So they accept there's a series of them, but they only visit the earth, turn the wheel of Buddha, turn the wheel of Dharma like Shakyamuni Buddha, and then they pass into Parinirvana, and that's the end of their involvement with sentient beings. Once they finish their life as a Buddha, even then, although they are Buddhas, they don't have a continual, activity as Buddhas once they've passed away from this life. Once they've turned the wheel of Dharma and passed away, that's it. So they're just very rare. They just come along in this series, but only one every few million eons or something, whenever it is. You see, so they accept a path to Buddhahood, and all those stories about the past lives of the Buddha in his Bodhisattva manifestations, he's born as a monkey, he's born as a this, that, and the other, an elephant, and so forth, and he's born as in this caste and in that country. So they accept all those stories. There's a progress of a bodhisattva, it's just that not many beings travel that path. So the one point for you, Radek, you were asking about the essence of the Tathagata Essence Sutra. You mentioned that this morning as being part of the third wheel or something. Yeah. So in my notes here it says that Tathagata Essence Sutra, if you're thinking about it in terms of time, when it was taught, then it is part of the third wheel. But according to our school of thinking, the Nalanda tradition, it's actually one of those sutras which is pertaining to the second wheel. It's not the second wheel per se, it's not a perfection of wisdom sutras, but it's one of those that teaches the same thing as the second wheel. So in the perfection of wisdom sutras and in Ornament of Clear Realizations, you do get a section on Buddha nature, mainly Buddha nature from the emptiness point of view, whereas in Tathagata Essence Sutra is Buddha nature from the point of view of the mental potential, the mind potential, is it? Is that right? The way your mind can turn into the mind of a Buddha. But in the perfection of wisdom, sort of, it's more or less talking about the emptiness of the mind as being the other aspect of this Buddha nature. Yeah, the empty nature of the mind is in, that's what is emphasized in the Perfection of Wisdom Sutras, but it's just those dovetail. You know, they're teaching doctrines that don't. You know, that's in tune with the second vehicle. That's what I'm trying to say. That's what my notes say. I'm not really familiar with the teaching that's described there. So we'll conclude with a bit of a meditation on bodhicitta, just as part of bring the practice of the. I don't mean right now, but I'm concluding this class. We've got till 5 o'clock, right? So I don't mean we're just going to start straight away, but that's on the agenda. Here we want to say. So the Nalanda tradition of Buddhism, that's taking the Perfection of Wisdom Sutras as their main object of study. So this is a course in India, but those sutras are very popular in China, and they go as far as Japan, Korea, don't they? And then, of course, go up into Tibet, Mongolia, and those places in still part of the Russian Federation, are they? Like Buryat and Kalmykia. So those are areas where Mahayana Buddhism, Perfection of Wisdom Sutra became established. So they say there's 17 Perfection of Wisdom Sutras that got translated into English, into Tibetan. They talk about the six mothers and the 11 sons. So a mother sutra is one where all the topics are covered, the ones where all the topics in the ornament for clear realizations, they're all covered. Whereas a sun sutra is one where it's just a partial explanation of some aspect of the Perfection of Wisdom, not the whole kind of a comprehensive explanation. The ones that are mainly commented on by the teachings that we're trying to follow, the commentaries we're trying to follow, as the small, the extensive, the small, the middling, and extensive. So that's the small one is the sutra of 8,000 verses. The middling is one of 25,000 verses, which must be pretty similar to the one we were reading, which is 18,000 lines. And then the very big one, this one is 100,000 verses. So I don't know how many volumes are. Do you know how many volumes there are there?
12.
12? For one sutra? How many volumes of the large Perfection of Wisdom Sutra? Yeah. 12. Blimey. Yeah. Almost an elephant load, that. Yeah, so we leave that one for you to translate, Mike. Is he? Yeah, well, he's probably got it all done by a computer now, a machine translation. You know, just feeds it in. Who's the guy? That guy, Paul Hackett. You see, he's part of the Robert Thurman crew. Have you met him? Yeah, there's this guy who's such a computer fanatic. Very nice guy, but I think his secret ambition is to be able to translate from Tibetan into English just by using computer language translation programs. Which might be very helpful with the Perfection of Wisdom Large Sutra, because it is so repetitive of these different categories, you know. No suffering, no cause of suffering, no eyes, no ears, no nose, no mouth. So that's how it gets to be so long, because all those categories are just every category you can imagine are all fitted in and repeated again and again and again. So, yes, bit of stamina needed. Anyway, so that's the Perfection of Wisdom Sutras. So now we should come on to the commentarial tradition. So how are those received? How are those explained? Who tells us what they actually mean? You know, we need some help, right? So that's where we get onto the commentaries. So the Perfection of Wisdom Sutras, this is there's no form, there's no feeling. So we need the commentary to come along and say, how do you understand that? And of course, there's many different ways, but of course, our own tradition, familiar, we say, well, no inherent existence. You know, there's no inherently existent form, no inherently existent feeling, and so forth. Okay, so that's, well, Nagarjuna might go that far. But then there's argument about that, you see. So then, well, why are things not inherently existent? After you put that little patch in, but then you need somebody to come along and say, well, okay, why are they inherently existent? Why are they not inherently existent? Because they're dependent arisings, or whatever the reason's going to be, you see. So you see how the commentary is needed to fill out the, you know, the Perfection of Wisdom Sutra sound awesome, or something, you know, they sound kind of, you know, quite sort of profound and sort of awesome, but that we do need a bit of commentary, you see, to really explain how to understand them. So we've got these two streams of commentary for the Perfection of Wisdom Sutras. Do you know what they are? Well, the Perfection of Wisdom Sutras, I wasn't thinking of Ornament for Clear Realizations. You're talking about two people have commented on the Ornament for Clear Realizations. But the two main streams of commentary for the Perfection of Wisdom Sutras. You can say mind only, and versus Madhyamaka, or middle way. So who are the proponents then? Thank you. Thank you. What's your name?
Sean.
Sean. Thank you, yeah. So these are the two people who stand at the head of the commentarial tradition of the Perfection of Wisdom Sutras, just as they stand at the head of the commentarial, you know, the explanatory tradition of Lam Rim teachings. In fact, let me see if I've got that with me. Okay, I have to save that for another time. Just, you know, the verses from the condensed Lam Rim, which show the place that Nagarjuna and Asanga hold in the sort of the lineage of passing down these teachings. Nagarjuna comes first, of course, 600 years after the Buddha passed away, approximately. Nobody can be quite sure about the dates of these people. And sort of a lot of myth and legends around the life of Nagarjuna and Asanga too. So they're kind of a bit lost in the sort of their greatness, you know, and sort of all the stories that surround them. But their speciality is Nagarjuna is explaining the emptiness side. Yeah. The view side, whereas Asanga, but we shouldn't say Asanga, we should say Maitreya, of course. Maitreya, who Asanga is, you know, getting his information from, he's the one who's explaining things from the grounds and paths point of view, the stages of the path, the multitudinous, you know, levels of this progress to Buddhahood. It's a long and, you know, sort of very sort of grandly presented kind of step-by-step approach, gradual approach. So that's your Nagarjuna. His classic text is the Fundamental Wisdom Stanzas. And then Maitreya, classic text, Ornament for Clear Realizations. So as taught to Maitreya, as taught to Asanga. So he comes along about a couple of hundred years later after Nagarjuna, not really, again, confident about those dates. So I associate Nagarjuna with Andhra Pradesh, Amaravati. There's a place in Andhra Pradesh where His Holiness gave Kalachakra teaching in about 2007. So this place is also famous for being the place where Buddha himself first gave the Kalachakra teaching. Did anybody attend that teaching? So that was a great Kalachakra down where Kalachakra was first taught by the Buddha. But it's very close to where Nagarjuna is supposed to have had his home monastery. And he is associated with Nalanda in the minds of Tibetans, and maybe he did even go there. Even though they had to travel on foot, these legendary figures, you know, they sort of moved about. But Andhra Pradesh is more towards South India, Central India, South India. And the place where his monastery is still there, you know, so it's just underwater, that's all. They built some big dam, so you can't actually go there. But they did move the ruins of his supposed monastery to this island in the middle of the dams, in the middle of the lake, created by the dam. So you can visit it, rebuilt, painstakingly rebuilt, you know, all these sort of broken pieces are put exactly as they were. But of course, when I was there, you have all these Tibetans who are, and people are really crazy to do the whole pilgrimage, and thousands of people attending the Kalachakra. So you have this vision of this sort of, you know, in Indian Forestry Department boat that will take you across to the kind of the island where Nagarjuna's sort of monastery has been rebuilt. But you have these nightmare visions, just like, you know, the people coming across from Turkey to Greece in these sort of little overcrowded boats and crossing the Mediterranean. It's a bit like that. It's because all these Tibetans are so eager to get on, you know what I mean? Sort of, they don't let anything stop them, so they're a bit reckless about health and safety. So I didn't try and go across. And I never got back at a more peaceful time, so to make the journey. So, but you know, in South India, a lot of these sort of ruins are still found, and there's not just the famous ones, there's so many like kind of rock cut cave monasteries and so forth. But it just still as peaceful and as kind of, you know, ever, and just abandoned to, maybe they're on some list of the archaeological department's sort of sites to be preserved, but there's very little visited. So you could, as a monk, you could go there and meditate quite peacefully, I'm sure. But the most famous one of those is actually is Ajanta. Has anybody been to Ajanta? Ajanta. That's in Maharashtra, isn't it? Yeah. So that one I associate with, rightly or wrongly, with Asanga. Have you ever heard of him being there? Well, would it be his main place of residence? I don't know. Whether he went to Nalanda? Not sure about that either. So I've heard that Asanga was there, and a very suitable place for him if he was, in a beautiful sort of rock-cut temples, and you know, dug out this lava flow of rock, you know, which covers a large section of central India. It's kind of a soft rock. It's kind of excavatable. So it wasn't so difficult to chisel out caves. And the monks sort of, it became sort of a fashionable way of for the monks to have, and nuns, I hope, too, had to have residences dug into these caves, you see. So it's like a... And then the Janta is famous because they have some of the paintings that were done hundreds of years ago are still to be... you know, there's still a few bits of them left. So that's what makes the Janta so special. Not only are these beautiful caves in this beautiful horseshoe of a gorge, a sort of still quite a peaceful place, but there are these really very good quality paintings that are just bodhisattvas, you know, scenes from the Buddha's life, scenes from the Buddha's previous lives, all kind of painted on the walls. Not much left, but you know, enough to impress, you know, enough to impress. So that was my memories of how I associate those two people, those two great figures with India, you see. Oh yes, and if you go to the British Museum, yeah, there's slabs of rock from this Amaravati stupa, you know, I'm going back to where Nagarjuna was in residence. So this stupa that marks a place where the Kalachakra teaching was given, there are big pieces of that, you know, stolen by the British or whatever, and stashed in the British Museum. You can say stolen, but, you know, had they been left where they were, they probably would have got broken up and used for other things. an easy source of stone for people who weren't particularly little Buddhists, you know. So maybe by having been stolen, they were protected from vandalism or just being used for mundane purposes. But if you go to the British Museum, they should be there. Have you been recently? Last time I went, they were closed for renovation, but that's a couple of years ago now. So they can be visited. So they've got some, you know, Nagarjuna would have seen those or helped to build them or what, I don't know. So that's some connection we can make with the British Museum. So they're both, Maitreya and Nagarjuna, they're both commentating on the Perfection of Wisdom Sutras. So that's our way into them. So one on the wisdom side, one on the method side. So maybe we should tell the story a bit about Asanga here. You know, Nagarjuna is lots of legends. Oh, we should tell his story, shouldn't we, really? I mean, he's even more important than Nagarjuna because he's credited with bringing the Perfection of Wisdom Sutras back into popularity. So, if we tell the story, I mean, it's always nice to hear these stories, isn't it? That the Tibetans, you know, this is the way I received, the introduction to the Perfection of Wisdom, is that although the Perfection of Wisdom Sutras were given in Buddha's lifetime, he taught them personally during his career, those 40-odd years when he's wandering across India, they became, they slipped out of sight, you know. They didn't sort of, they weren't the most popular of teachings. So that the teachings that are codified, you know, in the Abhidharma part of the Buddha's the Abhidharma basket of the Buddha's teachings, which is the wisdom of this of another kind, wisdom of personal selflessness and a path to Buddhahood, you know, based on the Four Noble Truths Sutra, without the strong emphasis on compassion, and just less imaginative about the number of Buddhas there are and so forth, sort of more a kind of a individual vehicle practice, foundational vehicle practice. So those are the teachings that became much more well known and much more, you know, this is what Buddhism is all about, sort of thing. And, you know, this the way they were taught is with this sort of a more limited view, you know, like as we're talking about this pluralism, you reduce everything down into the component part. And, even samsara and nirvana, they truly exist, yeah? So everything has to truly exist in the way it appears at some level. And then, you know, it's like this escapist mode, you know, wanting to get out of samsara and leave it all behind. And if you do that, you've done your duty, you've done your, you know, you've fulfilled your task. So that was the kind of wisdom that was maturing people's minds for this all this time until Nagarjuna comes along. Nagarjuna is prophesied by the Buddha, but doesn't come until maybe the first century of the Christian era, sort of 600 years after Buddha's passed away. But, you know, there's a prophecy there that conveniently predicts his arrival on the scene. And so, according to the legend, you see, these Perfection of Wisdom Sutras, while nobody knew much about them in the human level, they've been taken to the Naga realm and kept by the Nagas under the sea or under the water somewhere. So the Nagas are mythical creatures who, they have all sorts of different kind of places where they crop up. But although they're in the animal realm, some of them quite intelligent, and they're maybe not so well equipped to practice the path like a human being, but they acquire treasure, they keep valuable things like the Perfection of Wisdom Sutras with them in the underground, you know, sort of the palaces and so forth, or undersea, underwater palaces. So some of these Nagas are incredibly rich and sort of, you know, common animals at all. So Nagarjuna, at some point in his life, goes down to these realms, and he brings back the effects of wisdom sutras that they've been keeping for all this time until they were needed, you see. Actually, you can say until people's minds were matured by the Abhidharma type teachings. So when people are ready, then, you know, these perfection of wisdom sutras can be brought back and kind of unoffered, you know, and people start to understand them. Because while the Abhidharma teachers mature these people's minds, you know, over the generations, in the end they start to be a limiting factor, you know. They haven't understood the emptiness at the subtle level, so now they're ready for something better. So you can see how people who are keen practitioners of this foundational vehicle, they might query, well, really, are these perfection of wisdom sources, are they really the teachings of the Buddha? You know, they come on the scene quite late. And there's maybe, certainly in Western scholarship, who likes to debunk all the myths and miracles, there's a question of, you know, are these really the teachings of the Buddha, or did they come along later? You know, and in what circumstances did they come along? So these questions are asked by the masters of the tradition, people like Baba Viveka, and even Nagarjuna himself is kind of makes remarks about that these scriptures are the teachings of the Buddha, as I understand it. So we can decide that the Nagarjuna, who seems to us as a sort of a leading light, I don't know if he was a genius or not. I've tried to study his teachings, but, you know, they're challenging. So they're not vast and extensive like some of these perfection of wisdom sutras. They're very condensed, very cryptic, and very terse, and very eloquent verses. You know, so they don't yield their meaning easily. They ask you, if you want to understand these teachings, you have to put your hours in. They're not one of these, you know, instantaneous flash of enlightenment type of teachings. They, you know, he's going into sort of some complicated arguments. So he's arguing against these Abhidharmists. You think, you know, that it's enough to do that, and you say you've realized selflessness, you know. But what about the selflessness phenomena, you know? And so he's pulling their view apart and offering something, saying the perfection of wisdom sutras have got something a bit profounder, which unless you realize it, you can't say that you're cutting the root of cyclic existence. You can't say that you really understood the deeper message of the Buddha's teachings. And Buddhahood is what it's all about. Never mind you, the personal liberation. So he's pulling apart the teachings of the people who've, you know, popularized these Abhidharma sort of views. So I can't say whether he's a genius or not, really. But I'm keen to study his teachings a bit more. But, you know, you can look at people like this Holiness Dalai Lama, you can say, well, there we have a genius, you know, there we have somebody, almost a living master, we can say, yeah, well. And they're prepared to say, you know, and you read the writings of Tsongkhapa, who, you know, is a little bit more familiar with the writings of Tsongkhapa, because we're studying those, you know, difficult texts of the ancient Indian masters through the slightly less kind of, you know, cryptic texts of the Tibetan masters like Tsongkhapa, and you say, well, they really revere Nagarjuna to the utmost, you know, 100% limit. So Nagarjuna really is the person who understands what Buddhist teachings are. You know? So then, if you're going to come along and say, yeah, but the sutras that he's relying on, and they were just sort of, you know, some sort of a later development, some sort of later addition to the canon that were sort of ascribed to be sutras of the word of the Buddha, but actually they weren't written by the Buddha himself. They were written 600 years later or something. You know, well, who are you going to believe? I mean, it seems better to believe Nagarjuna, who's quite sort of clear that he's explaining the word of the Buddha, than a kind of Western scholars for all their, you know, linguistic competence and how they're deciding these sutras come along later, and they've got maybe some very good reasons analyzing the style in which they're written or whatever. I don't know how they've come to the conclusions. So, you know, it seems better to believe that the geniuses of our tradition would be the people to follow rather than Western scholars who are not even claiming to be Buddhists. I don't know. So there is some question about that. And certainly you can see how mythical the story is, that how they come back into popularity. But anyway, Nagarjuna does a very good job, you see. His teachings have lived through the ages, you know. And people following in him, after him, have commented again and again on his amazing verses, you know, so that they've kept their... that the living tradition of understanding what Nagarjuna is saying has been, you know, stretched all the way down to the present day. In India, we can mention people like Baba Viveka of Buddhapalita and Chandrakirti, of course. You know, these are the great masters of that tradition, passing on then to Tsongkhapa and people in India and Tibet. So that's the story of Nagarjuna. But then, a little bit later, you see, Asanga comes along. So he's, again, the monk who wants to develop compassion. He's really fascinated by the Perfection of Wisdom Sutras, finds them very hard to understand, you know. So he's in meditation for 12 years now. So he's just living in his solitary cave somewhere, Ajanta or some other less well-known place. And so he's striving to understand, you know, how do you develop universal compassion? How do you understand this sort of, you know, deep view of no true existence and so forth? So he's showing that fantastic determination, 12 years in retreat. But he suffers from discouragement. And so he decides he's going to give up. He's getting nowhere. So he leaves his cave. But then he sees a spring, you know, so there's been water dripping from this little spring, just drip of water. And the stone underneath the spring has become quite smooth, you see, just from the dripping of water. This lump of hard stone has gradually become smooth and rounded. So he sees that, he's very impressed, you see. So, you know, he decides he's got to persist. So he goes back into retreat, you know, for another 3 years. But again, he becomes discouraged. So this time, he leaves his cave, you know, dejected. And I think this time he sees something like a swallow's nest or something like that. So there, the nest is plastered to the wall of rock. And again, you know, around the nest, the stone has become quite smooth. So what has made this smooth? What has made the rock to be smooth? Well, it's just the wings of the bird brushing against it, you know, over the generations, has smoothed this stone. And so again, he thinks, you know, well, I've just got to persist. I've got to go back in there, keep at it. So he goes back in for another 3 years. But then, again, he gets dejected. Again, he thinks, I'm useless at this. This is a complete sort of bad career choice. Got to do something else now. So he leaves the cave after 9 years, staggers out. But then I think he sees something else. He sees a guy polishing needles. You know, it must have been very hard to make needles in the old days. You know, so a sort of handmade needle for stitching. So this guy is polishing needles with a cloth. He's polishing the metal to make it smooth, so it'll pass through the cloth when he's stitching. So he sees this man, you know, polishing iron with a cloth or something like that. So again, he's really impressed, and he thinks he has to go back into retreat. So off he goes, meditates for another 3 years. So then finally, after 12 years, I think again, he gets completely fed up. You know, he says, right, I'm really leaving this time. I've had enough. I can't do any more. So I haven't got a clue about compassion. and nothing's happened, you know. So he's praying to Maitreya, you see. He's praying to Maitreya, the future Buddha. Just like, you know, Lama Zappa recommends, sort of, for guidance, how to understand, how to develop the bodhicitta and the correct view. So he comes across, this time he comes across the dog, who's a beggar-type dog, you know, which is very common in India. And the dog's got some awful wound on its leg or something like that, and the wound is crawling with maggots. So he wants to clean up this wound and revive this dog and give the dog a bit of help. But that means he's got to get rid of the maggots. But of course, they're alive too. So he ends up saying, "Well, I've got to help the maggots. I can't just take the maggots off and leave the and help the dog, but not the maggots." So he has to cut a piece of his own leg off. He gets a knife and cuts a piece of his own flesh off. Then he starts picking the maggots off. But he can't pick the maggots off with his fingers because, you know, you squeeze them to death, you know. So he decides he has to pick the maggots off with his lips. So reaching down to pick the maggots up with his lips to be very gentle to them. Well, that's the story. I'm only telling what's there, you know, what we were taught. So just as he's reaching down to pick the maggots off with his lips, then Maitreya appears before him. You know, they have to go right to the end and sort of to make the story so far-fetched that it just starts to sound a bit ridiculous. So that's just typical, isn't it? But anyway, that's when Maitreya appears to him. So, you know, so finally, Asanga's got rid of enough of his, whatever it is, his obscurations, so that he can have a direct view of Maitreya. And so, you know, it's like the dog was Maitreya, right? So, but that's all he could see at the beginning, was just Maitreya as a dog, you know. He couldn't see him as for what he was. This benevolent, compassionate being. He just hadn't got that sort of karmic purity or something. Aha. Uh-huh. So Maitreya then transmits to him these texts. So the Ornament for Clear Realizations is one of those texts, but there are others. So that's there's a half a dozen. I can't remember how many texts of Maitreya there are. Six maybe, I'm guessing, but I can't remember exactly. So this is the one that becomes part of the Geshe Studies program. This is the one that's most popular with the Gelugpa traditional education system. But the others are also much studied by others. And people describe it like Gareth Sparham, the translator. He's, you know, a mixture of middle way and mind-only view. So that's kind of, you know, where you're situated in terms of tenets, according to Gareth Sparham anyway. I'm not sure that the Tibetans would necessarily agree with him, the Gelugpas, but that's his opinion. So, at the same time as explicating the all the details, you know, the very hidden details, really, of the various meditations and concentrations and kind of paths and transitions that you make on your sort of long evolution towards Buddhahood. So, as well as sort of explicating those and making them manifest, Asanga also begins teaching the mind-only view. So you've got the Abhidharmakas who are teaching this sort of withdrawn monastic type of escapist, realist type of interpretation of Buddha's teachings. And then you've got the devastating critique of Nagarjuna, although it's, you know, logically flawless and, you know, extremely profound or radical. So it's not something that can appeal to the middle-of-the-road Buddhist, because it is so sharp, it's so kind of, you know, intellectual, or it's so, you know, radical in that nothing exists or nothing inherently exists. So people start to feel that it's so near to nihilism that they can't go near it, you know. Something that offers an alternative to those, it was this mind-only view. So it became associated, you know, he popularizes the bodhisattva ideal, you see, not just the sort of intellectual devastating exposure of emptiness, which is Nagarjuna's speciality, but, you know, the actual paths of progress that a bodhisattva makes. So much more talking about the six perfections and the activities of a bodhisattva in the world. So kind of maybe more appealing to certain, you know, mainstream society or something, you know. So the bodhisattva is somebody who gets involved in the world, makes many sacrifices for the benefit of society and benefit of, you know, animal society, never mind just human society. So somebody who's always working, you know, selflessly, tirelessly for the society, just like the bodhisattva king, you know, Dalai Lamas of Tibet were trying to do. So he popularizes that ideal of you know, activity in the world, the merit side of becoming Buddha. So it's said to have been followed then, you know, that era of Indian civilization, following, say, second century AD, 3rd century AD. Then this is one of those golden ages of Indian civilization where, or golden age of Buddhism in India, maybe as well, you see. So Asanga's works are kind of, you know, they're sort of inspiring that sort of invigoration of Buddhism in a new way, with the mind-only view, and that approach to the sort of Mahayana path. So that's the two sort of stories today, Nagarjuna and Asanga. So that's who the Nalanda tradition takers are, you know, their founding fathers. The way they talk about them is breakers open of the chariot way. If you translate literally the way the epithet that given by, you know, the people who are praising them and describing them as the people who are opening up the way to understand the Buddha's teachings. Yeah, of course, the Buddha gave the teachings, so he's the person who's the founding sort of father or something. But these are described as breaking open the chariot way, you know. So they're making the path so that other people can follow to understand the perfection of wisdom sutras. So those are the two paths, the two sort of varieties of approach. As you read the Perfection of Wisdom Sutras a bit more, you can see they're very heavily talking about emptiness. That's true of the heart of the Wisdom Sutra, isn't it? And probably parts of the sutra that you were reading. So the main emphasis is on emptiness. So that is the, whatever you call it, the explicit teaching of the sutras. But Maitreya and Asanga's presentation, that is sort of the hidden meaning of the sutras. It's not so obvious from the sutras, all these different levels and kind of, you know, progressions and sort of varieties of concentration and so forth that come in the Ornament of a Clear Realization. So that's not that's called the hidden side of the teachings. So while Nagarjuna is commenting on the explicit meaning of the sutras, Maitreya Asanga, they're commenting on the hidden meaning of the sutras. So it's another way of differentiating them. One is the explicit meaning, one is the hidden meaning. Yeah, so that's so I've got a bit of a legendary background. I think we better stop there, do a bit of meditation. So next we can look at a bit about how these where the Ornament of Clear Realization fits in the study program of the Tibetan tradition, you know, the Gelugpa tradition. That's part of the sort of Geshe study stuff. And then we can maybe go on to the Ornament of Clear Realizations itself after that. That's how it's set out in our, you know, points of general outline of studies for this weekend. So, Need to take a little break first, a little breather. Then we do 15 minutes of meditation. I think I'm just going to go visit the bathroom. So just stretch your legs if you need to, or stand up, whatever.